Thank you very much. First off, thank you all for coming out today. Thank you to the various people involved in organizing and coordinating, whether it be the source sheets, the lunch, the three sessions, and thanks to Rabbi Turchiner for starting us off. I'm now going to pass around a packet of sign-in sheets. If we can go just around the U and then to the inside, please sign in so that we can, first of all, have records that you were here in case you're looking for credit or something like that, as well as for the purposes of reaching out by email as a follow-up or something along those lines. Finally, you will notice on some of the tables sprinkled around, there are some flyers for our evening of tribute that's coming up less than a month away. If you're interested, you can find details on there of how to sign up or register for it. Now, I'd like to begin the talk. The talk is entitled The Business Lunch in the Eyes of Halacha and the CRA. And when I had chosen the topic, somebody very wise came to me and said, you know, you may run into a bit of a problem with that topic. And I said, oh, why is that? And they said, well, you know as well as I do that in terms of the actual tax laws, halacha is open and closed. Whatever the government says you can do, you can do. There's no real, you know, question within Jewish law or even within ethics to say if the government allows you to write something off as taxes, that's open and shut. So that's really not going to be the angle that we look at it today. What I'd like to do today is to present what's essentially an employment law case and to try to look at some of the applications that we can get from the tax laws that are applicable to similar situations. So that's the way we're going to run it, and I'd like to use the following case study. I'll note in advance, the case study is vague for a reason. It's purposefully vague so that we can look at what would be, you know, in different particulars if there were specific cases within this, and therefore cut me a little bit of slack if I didn't identify the business here or some other details of the story. We will cover each of the different scenarios as we go through the sources. So, here's our case study. We have Jack, who's an employee of Joe's business. Okay, Joe's the owner. And he's sent on a business trip from Toronto to London, England. While in London, Jack meets a client for lunch. Okay, it's unclear, again, from our case, whether or not this was the purpose of his trip entirely or not. But, again, we'll cover that. Jack meets a client for lunch, at which the two of them spend $1,000 on various alcoholic beverages and meats. Upon his return to Toronto, Jack goes into the office. He paid for this meal on his credit card, and he bills his employer, Joe, says, listen, you got to pay me back. You got to reimburse me for that $1,000 meal that I had. And he talks about how, of course, he built such goodwill between the client and the company and how the client now will certainly use the company in the future. And Joe, the owner, says, what are you talking about? First of all, I never told you to have this particular specific lunch meeting. But number two, Joe argues that that was a ridiculously frivolous expense. What are you spending $1,000 on a lunch? Are you out of your mind? He argues that Jack clearly overspent on the meal and that even if he had authorized it, he should only have to pay for a small fraction of the cost. What factors should be considered in looking at this from a Jewish legal point of view? If this were brought to a Beis Din, how would they rule in this case and what factors would they look at? So let's begin. Again, as we go through, we'll try to see if there are some indications that tax law can give us that will help us resolve this dispute between Jack and Joe, the employer and the employee, in terms of drawing the background of why the tax laws may have been set up in a particular way to consider certain things business expenses or certain things not. So the first thing to look at any dispute between an employer and employee is, of course, if it was already discussed. If there is a company policy, if there was some agreement between the employer and employee prior to them engaging in this particular expense, that would obviously be what should be followed. And that's clear from source number one, the Shulchan Aruch. The background here is the Mishnah in Masechet Bava Kama, in chapter 7, which begins as Sofer Zapolim, one hires workers. Okay, the Mishnah tells us that we follow the custom of the place that they're in. Whatever it is, whatever the practice is in the geographical location that this is taking place, that's what we have to follow. However, the Tosfot commentary notes that that's only when they didn't agree on something beforehand. If, in fact, the employer and employee came to terms on something, then we disregard the local custom and we can follow what they set with each other. Okay, and this is, again, codified in source number one in the Code of Jewish Law in Shulchan Aruch, One who hires laborers and told them to rise early and remain late to work in a place where the practice is for them not to rise early or remain late to work. He may not force them even if he adds to their wages, since he did not stipulate this at the time that he hired them. So even in our case, we'd certainly say that if there was something in place from beforehand, that's what would be followed. So if at the outset they had had a discussion about this, or if there was a company policy like we actually see for a number of companies, if you Google it, you can find online various interesting policies for different companies as to how and when they reimburse employees in their business. Interesting to see, for example, I took a look at the Government of Ontario website to see what their employees and the different people at different levels of government are allowed to be spending and what they'll be reimbursed for. There was a nice section about alcohol expenses and when or when not government employees would be reimbursed for alcohol purchases on their trips. Yes?
Yeah, you're not clarifying on this. If you read this, it doesn't clarify to be told to rise early and remain late at the time he hired him, or he said it afterwards. Doesn't say it. It says
so this case.
Was told to rise early. So.
Yes, correct. This is only after he hired them. But we say he may not force them, even if he adds to their wages, since he didn't stipulate this at the time that he hired them. If he did stipulate it at the time that he hired them, then he would be able to. Correct. That's the implication here. But you have other policies you can see online as to when the employees would be reimbursed for what they spent, and that's quite common. Interestingly, it's not only just companies that can set terms in advance. There are actually some governments that will set rules as to when reimbursements should be given. I saw an interesting news article about that recently this year, at the beginning of this year, some states like Illinois actually began to have laws for their entire state as to what is required from a reimbursement point of view. We're not going to look at exactly what that would apply to here. We're going to still look at it from a Jewish point of view. But the question then becomes, if there is some sort of governmental rule, how does that apply to the Jewish legal process? And that is a question of what we know as dina de malchuta dina. Dina de malchuta dina, in short, is that we follow the law of the government whenever possible. We follow the king's law. The question is, in a case like this, which is a dispute between two people, if that principle applies. Some people say it applies to any rules that a government will set. So if the government says that this is what governs a dispute between an employee and an employer in this case, then we must follow that. Others, though, like we see in source number 2, Rabbi Isaiah of Trani and Piskei Riaz, explain that it only applies when it's for the king or the government's benefit. And really, as he explains, it seems to me that we don't say the law of the land is the governing law unless it is something which the king decrees for his benefit, such as taxes, similar things, but laws between two individuals should be judged according to Torah law. And these people point out that we have to have some remnant of Jewish law. If we just say everything follows the government, well, the government has laws for everything. Everything will just end up in secular courts, and that's not a great idea. So therefore, when it's simply a dispute between two people, they can still settle it in a Jewish court, according to many authorities. This is putting aside all of the other issues involved with taking things to secular court from a Jewish perspective. But there is a point that remains, and it's noted by Rabbi Chaim Cohen in a similar case in the Business Halacha Week newsletter. He writes, nonetheless, even according to those situations in which Dina de Malchuta does not apply, so when we will not say that we have to follow the law of the land, rather, we can follow an internal Jewish law, it often generates a common commercial practice. The fact is, where the government mandates something, you would say that 90, 99, 95% of the businesses, if not 100%, will be following those in their own practices. And what halacha does take into account, what Jewish law does take into account, is that common practice. And therefore, in contractual issues such as those between employer and employee, buyer and seller, landlord and renter, it's not feasible to stipulate everything. Therefore, the common commercial practice is binding in these areas whenever not stipulated. Otherwise, as we said in source number 1, the common custom will prevail here in terms of defining it. So, how do we apply common practice to this case? Here we can look back to a very similar case, actually, that's expressed in the Talmud itself. Just one section earlier, one chapter earlier, in the Babylonian Talmud and in the Mishnah, in Bava Metzia, in chapter 6, we have a similar case that arises in a Mishnah. And the Mishnah tells us, one who hires laborers, in source number 4, and they deceived one another. So somebody hires laborers and they deceived one another. How do they deceive one another? That's what we're going to find out. They have nothing but complaints against each other. And the Talmud explains, it doesn't say And we're reading again in the middle of source number 4. They reneged on the agreement with one another. It does not say, rather, they deceived one another. Meaning, the laborers deceived one another. How is it that laborers deceive one another? What's the case? The case is where the employer said to his employee, go and hire laborers for me, okay? So I'm working for someone here, and they tell me, go and hire me a worker, okay? And I went ahead and deceived those laborers. And so we say, okay, well, that's it's true, that's more specific, but how did this actually happen? How did it go down? Says the Talmud. The Talmud continues. If the employer told him, hire me laborers for 4 dinars, okay, that was a currency in their day, and he went and told them that they hired for 3 dinars, why do they have complaints? They heard and accepted the terms. So we're talking about a case where the owner of a company sent the employer sent an employee and said, I'd like you to hire me more people for my company. And he told them, I'd like you to hire them, and I'm willing to pay 4 dinar. The employee then goes to these new prospective employees and says, we'd like to hire you for 3 dinar. Are you okay with that? And they say, yep, all good. So says the Talmud, obviously that's not the case in which they have complaints because they agreed to the terms of 3 dinar. That can't be what's going on. So the Talmud continues. He says, okay, if the employer now, so maybe it's a different case. Maybe the employer, says the Talmud, asked him to hire the people for 3 dinar, and he went ahead and offered them a 4th dinar, okay, as payment, in which case one could see why people would be upset at each other. Okay, so asks the Gemara, if the employer said to him to hire laborers for 3 dinars, and he went and told them their pay would be 4, well, it depends. If he told them that their wages, the additional dinar, would be paid by him, then obviously there are no complaints about this. Okay, if the employee himself had to volunteered to buck up that 4th dollar so that the employees would come and work, then again, there should be no dispute. Rather, the Talmud concludes that the case was where this employee went and the owner told him, the employer told him, I want you to hire workers for 3. And the employee went ahead and told the workers 4, and the boss is going to pay you. He's going to pay you 4. So that's why there's a dispute. The boss is saying, hey, I only told you to hire them for 3 dinar. And the guy's saying, that's nice. I decided to hire them for 4.
Is he a subcontractor? Is he considered an employee? So we're gonna
talk about the status of these employees and these circumstances a little bit later on. But it seems that he's actually in the employ of the balabayas of the owner or employer in this case. Now, if that's the case, so we've got the owner thinks he's going to be paying 3, and the workers are told 4. So asks the Talmud, if so, why don't we check how much laborers are generally hired for? And at this point in the Talmud, and this is really how it ends, we say, well, we look around. If in that city, in that place, laborers generally get paid 4, the owner, the employer, will have to pay all 4 to the laborers. Even though he only said he wanted to pay 3, too bad. We follow the common practice. So too, again, and if it is the case that they only get paid 3, then the laborers, even though they were offered 4 by this employee, the employee would either have to fill in the cost or they would have to agree to work for 3. Looking back at our case, it seems somewhat analogous. The employer presumably wants, in some capacity, the employee to build these business connections while he's abroad. Okay, again, whether that was the sole purpose of his trip or not is something that will become relevant later. However, he obviously doesn't want him to be spending $1,000 on, you know, wine, beer, spirits, and meat at his lunch. So if that's the case, perhaps we should look toward the common practice as to what is it that people do when they engage in such business lunches. Is something like this considered a normal thing to do, to spend $1,000 on alcohol and meats? And then to say, oh, this was clearly a business expense. I was becoming good buddies with the guy. In which case, the employee in our case can go back to his boss, he can go back to Joe, and he can say, listen, everybody does this, so you should reimburse me for my $1,000 spent. And that's really the question that we have. Or, on the other hand, if common practice is that you take a guy out for lunch, you spend $50, then spending $1,000 seems quite above and beyond, then he shouldn't have to reimburse him. So now the question arises, what other factors dictate when an employee can spend an employer's money? And this is really going to get to the crux of the issue here. And then in the future, we're going to try to apply what we know about the CRA's view of business lunches to see if the employee indeed can go back to the employer and say, hey, you know, this would be considered a business lunch based on the grounds of the government for this particular purpose. So we're in section, really the next section, may an employee spend an employer's money and expect to be reimbursed? The simple way I think that we would all think is no. If you look at another similar case, all of you, I'm assuming, work in some sort of office, or many of you work in some sort of office. If you ever take things from the office, use them, perhaps food, drink, maybe writing utensils, paper, what are the halachos in regards to that in spending what's really your employer's money if you're an employee of this or any company? The Shulchan Aruch tells us in source number 5, the shavings of wood produced by a carpenter's plane belong to him. If you had a carpenter who was working for someone, and there are shavings of wood that remain, which were somewhat valuable, the carpenter was allowed to take them home. If the chips of wood were produced by a hatchet, they belong to the employer. But if it was larger chunks of wood, those would go back to the employer. Okay, so sometimes the employee gets to keep some of the stuff from his employer, really what should technically be the employer's money. And other times it goes back to the employer. If he was working with the employer present, even the shavings produced by the plane belong to the employer. And the Rama tells us, one of the about 16th century equals almost in setting up Jewish law alongside the Shulchan Aruch and what he called the Mapa, he writes, so too for all work, anything that the employer is careful about belongs to him, but that which he is not careful about belongs to the worker. And this is a very important point. He sets the precedent saying that it also depends not only on the local custom, but also on what the employer cares about. So, going back to our case, if we know that Jack, our employee, if Jack is aware that Joe, his employer, doesn't like to spend lots of money on business lunches, that too is a factor in determining whether or not he can expect to be reimbursed. Not necessarily can he go back to his employer and say, common practice dictates that you should pay for my $1,000 lunch. If we know that the employer is particular about things like that, this Rama explains that we may not just rely on the common custom because we know that the employer does have particular things that he is concerned about. Okay, so this would be an additional reason, meaning putting aside common custom, we now also need to look at what the employer generally cares about. Now, after the fact, the employer coming forward and saying, now I care, that may not be enough to trigger this ruling. It may have to be something that the employee had advance notice of that the employer would be particular about. All clear? Okay, so in addition to common custom, what does the employer think?
Most employers are concerned about costs and, you know, what's incurred.
But yes.
They don't stipulate, like, give very specific policies as to how much.
Correct.
And to say, I'm concerned about it, is that sufficient? Like, you know what I mean? Like, why would the $1,000 is a little more extreme in terms of quantum. But let's say it was $250, let's say. You know, something a little more within the realm of possibilities. But yet the employer says, I'm concerned about costs, you know what I mean? Like, but doesn't say something specific as to how much costs should be incurred for a business lunch. Then what does that mean exactly that the employer is concerned?
Well, the question is really if the employee should have thought in advance and said, my boss is going to kill me if I do this. And if he would have thought that even though it's not in a contract and it wasn't discussed, well, then that's something that he has to bear the responsibility for. That's essentially what we're coming to say here, is if it's realistic to think that the boss would be very upset about this, which I think it kind of is in this case. Again, depending on exactly which business and what types of clients and everything else involved, but that's what we're referring to, a case where it wasn't stipulated in advance, but we kind of understand that the boss would care about something like this. That's the purpose of this source in adding to the discussion. Yes?
So if I have a bar mitzvah, and I'm self-employed, and I invite all potential clients, I can deduct the caterer?
So I'm not talking about tax law here. As I'm not the expert in tax law, I'm sure you've got a room full of accountants and lawyers. What I do want to do is use those laws later on to see if they can apply back to our dispute. But I cannot say anything about that. Also, I'm on recording, so I'd get in real trouble. Okay, one other point is that in this case also, the money is already in someone's hand. Okay, we have a general rule, what we call hamotzi mechaver ol varaya, one who comes to claim money from another person, the burden of the proof is on the person who's requesting the money. Okay, so if the employee already spent it, he's now got to convince the employer to give him the money, and he's got to bring proof to say that he should get reimbursed. Others actually disregard this reason for various purposes, but we're not going to get into that because I do want to get through the bulk of our shiur. We're about 20 minutes in already. Now, what might be the grounds for saying that, yes, maybe the employee can spend his employer's money here? That goes back to a very interesting case of agency, shlichut, and it goes as follows. Okay, we'll read the English here in source number 7. This is a general background to how Jewish law views agency and how we'll apply it to our case. If one said to his agent, go and sell land or merchandise, or purchase, again, land or merchandise for me, the agent may buy or sell and perform his agency, and all of his actions are lasting. Okay? So as long as you've assigned someone to be your shaliach, to be your agent, they have the ability to purchase and sell on your behalf. And the person who appoints the agent, in fact, does not even need a legal acquisition or witnesses in order to appoint the agent. Just simple discussion between the two parties is required. Witnesses would only be necessary to clarify the matter if one of them denied it later on. So, here's our case. If the agent, paragraph number 2 in source number 7, performed a transaction against the wishes of his sender, it has no legal ramifications. This is specifically when he notified the third party that he was the agent of this individual. Therefore, even if he bought or sold by legal acquisition, meaning according to Jewish law, if it was found that he went against the wishes of the sender, the purchase is invalid and should be returned. But if he did not notify the third party that he was the agent of this individual, the purchase is valid and the dispute will be between the agent and the one who sends him. So, if I were to give an example of this, let's say, anybody want to volunteer to send me to the bakery? Any volunteers? Someone? Can I volunteer? Okay, Chaim volunteers to send me to the bakery. Chaim asks me, he's going to be the sender, I'm going to be his agent, to please buy him a Danish from the bakery. Jewish law tells us that if I enter the bakery, instead of buying a Danish, I buy a brownie on Chaim's behalf, that is not valid, that transaction, even though I gave the guy the money and everything. Not valid. And now the question is, in what way is invalid? So if I notified the bakery that I was coming on behalf of Chaim to buy a Danish, and I then bought a brownie from them, then I actually return it to the bakery. The bakery is required to give me back my money because the transaction was invalid. Chaim didn't ask me for a Danish. If, however, I don't notify the bakery, then I'm the one in trouble. The bakery says, hey, we sold you a brownie because we thought you wanted a brownie. And Chaim can come to me and say, I'm not giving you back money for buying my brownie. I asked you for a Danish. So that's exactly the way the law stands here. And now here's really, really close to our case. Third paragraph. If the agent erred and overpaid, even slightly, the purchase is void. So if I went into the bakery now as Chaim's agent, and I walk in, and a regular price for a Danish is $3, and they charge me $3.05, I overpay, Chaim has every right to tell me, sorry, I only wanted you to buy a Danish for $3. But $3.05, I'm sorry, that's too much beyond it, and you know what? Again, I'm stuck up the creek as his agent. If the agent dared and overpaid even slightly, the purchase is void, whether land or merchandise, as the sender can say to him, I sent you for my benefit, not for my detriment. So anytime there's an overpaying, we have this phrase, okay, which is an Aramaic phrase, originally it's also said in Hebrew by some, I sent you for my benefit, not for my detriment. Therefore, if they stipulated that he would be made his agent for benefit or detriment, then in those cases, even if he sold him a manez worth, which is 100 dinar of land for 1 dinar, meaning even if you paid 100 times the price or you sold for 1/100th of the price, it doesn't matter. So long as that agreement was made in advance that I'm sending you as my agent, whether it ends up coming back to bite me or whether or not it ends up being good for me, then the transaction will be valid even if he overpays or underpays. Okay? And if you skip down one more line to the Ramah, okay, that's in the middle of the last paragraph, one who commanded another to take care of a certain business matter, listen carefully, you may hear echoes of our case, and he paid money for it, okay? So, an employer or someone who's going to send an agent, and he commands another person to take care of a certain business matter, and this person, this agent, pays money for it. If he paid more than would be normal to pay under these circumstances, the sender does not need to reimburse his agent since he never expected that the agent would pay so much. But if he did not pay more than would be normal, he must repay him. So when it comes to the relationship between a sender and an agent, that relationship, we have the claim that I sent you for my benefit, not for my detriment. So if this were to be the relationship here in our case, the employer could go to the employee and say, hey, I sent you for my detriment, not, I sent you for my benefit, not for my detriment. And therefore, what are you going ahead spending $1,000 of my money? Are you out of your mind? That's not in your rights to do. On the other hand, it's not necessarily clear that we should view this person as a shaliach, as an agent. He's really an employee, and in some ways, he may qualify as, in certain ways, more of a partner in this case. And we know that when it comes to partners, as we see in source number 8, in case of partners, it's not possible to say, I sent you for my benefit, not for my detriment. Hey, you're partners. And to some extent, when you're sending an employee and you're giving him whatever latitude to engage in business activities, one could argue that the employer, it's as if he said to begin with, that listen, you go and use your judgment, and whatever you do, I'm going to pay back for. It's almost as if he stipulated that by sending him and giving him this power. On the other hand, you could argue that no, he doesn't give him that power. He's simply giving him the ability to use some of his resources in order to further a certain goal. And in fact, if you look in source number 9, which we're not going to read inside, the case of a power of attorney, if someone is granted power of attorney, for example, a lawyer who's representing someone in certain cases, if they decide to waive the charges on their own, if someone's being represented and they're actually given full control over the dispute in this case, and they pardon the other party, that actually has no meaning because the person who wrote the power of attorney to this person can say, I'm sorry, I sent you for my benefit, not to have me forgive the money. So even we see when there is a certain power invested in an employee, it still is considered as if he's an agent and the owner or the employer has the right to say, I sent you for a good purpose, not for a bad purpose. All clear? So again, it's questionable as to whether or not in this case we'd consider the employee as an agent, in which case we can tell him, listen, that's not why I sent you, or if he'd be more like a business partner, in which case that wouldn't apply and he'd be able to have a claim and say, listen, you know, I'm simply representing you here and perhaps you don't have such a claim to make. Now, here's where we get to the real crux of the matter. In what ways is our case different than the case outlined? And this should say source 7. Originally, I had a few more sources here. I trimmed it down. This is the trimmed down version. How is it different than the case outlined in source number 7? And how might the differences change our ruling? So I'd be happy to hear from you. I can grab another carrot or something in the meanwhile. How is our case study different from what we saw in this Ramah about one who commanded another to take care of a business matter? Yes.
The employee is participating in lunch and he's drinking the alcohol. So it's not just like a case, the other case we talked about, where someone is sending someone else to do something, mm-hmm. or someone is doing something on behalf of someone else and claiming a reimbursement. Here, the agent himself, or the employee himself, has personal incentive to have spend $1,000 on lunch because he eats half, he's one of the parties at the lunch. So maybe in such a case, its credibility is a little bit more, challengeable or strained than in order. He's not purely objective here. He's a benefit.
Interesting.
He himself is a benefit, and he's asking the employer to reimburse not just what he laid out for the other for the customer, but for himself.
But what would you say about the part that he laid out for the other customer? That wouldn't apply.
Wouldn't apply so much to the other. Well, no, because you can't really go to lunch and eat and have like the top steak and alcohol and have a salad.
Okay.
That's not
going to
work.
Okay, interesting. Well, we'll get back to that a little bit. Yes?
This is a business development lunch. There's no direct purchase or sale of anything. You're just hoping down the road you're going to get some business.
Excellent. So I think that's really one of the key points that I was looking for here. And again, we'll get back to the personal involvement factor later. But this is also not really purchasing something. You can't say that this is akin to purchasing something where the sale is valid or the sale is not valid based on what I wanted you to do. Because you're not purchasing anything. You're having lunch with a guy, but what's purchased is purchased. They both ate the lunch already. That's not the question. The question is if this was a worthwhile investment in order to try to get this guy back for later, in order to try to build goodwill with this client. So that's a definite difference.
Order a cheap lunch. If he asks for filet mignon, you can't ask for a hamburger. You look bad.
Okay, and you could certainly make that argument back in return to the point raised before. Any other questions?
The Rama says, it sounds like the employer can deny the entire expense. It's not like he's required to pay the portion that's reasonable and not the excessive.
But that's only if he sent him without saying that I'm sending you, permission to do what you wish.
Right.
That's the case which the Rama is referring to. The Rama would agree, one second, that if you sent him and you said, I'm giving you certain permission to do business activities on my behalf, that he certainly would have to reimburse him.
It didn't even make clear from the case whether the employer authorized him to take you know, a client out to lunch. He just said,
yes.
I'm sending you on a business trip. So
that is, so okay, so that is exactly the point I wanted someone to raise here. In this case, the question of whether or not you can say, "Letikuni shidarticha v'lo lavatutich," I sent you for my benefit and not for my detriment, depends on whether the guy sent him to do this or not. And that's why I think it's important. If this was something on the side, the guy could say, "Listen, I didn't want you to do this altogether." But if the purpose of the trip was to take clients out to lunch, it's very hard to defend a claim by the employer of saying, "Well, I sent you for my benefit. Well, you did really send me to do this." It's true, the employer, you know, didn't expect him to spend so much, but he did kind of send him for that purpose, and it's questionable as to whether or not you can differentiate between overspending and the entire thing being all sort of denied by the employer. So that's an excellent point. Yes?
So I'm just going to complicate it a little bit. Let's say during the course of that lunch, they transacted business.
So I'm going to leave that for later, if you don't mind.
Okay,
that's going to be important here. Last comment, and then we'll move on.
The way I'm reading this, and I'm trying to read this legally, when he basically clearly stated, since Shimon was not there, he made clear to wherever the witnesses were.
We haven't read that source yet, I don't think.
Well, I thought we were set to go through it.
Okay. Sorry, so we're going to get to it in 1 second. Okay? Now, one further factor is guessing based on other details of the agreement. Because of time, I actually don't want to go through this in detail. It's a fascinating case that's found in the Truma Sedeshin from about 400 years ago, about 500 years ago even. And he has a section where basically the case was someone hired someone. Reuven hires Shimon for a flat fee, a very large flat fee, in a circumstance under which generally expenses are paid. However, in this case, Reuven, who was sending Shimon to do this and paying him, the employer, was absent before Shimon left. Shimon made it clear to other people and said, "I'm expecting to be reimbursed for my expenses, but the guy's not here." Now, when he comes back from the trip, the employer is back, and he says, "I'm not giving you expenses. I paid you a huge amount of money as a flat fee." And Shimon says, "Well, it doesn't matter. The custom is that everybody gets paid for their expenses when they do this type of work." And there's a dispute as to, in that case, whether it's more appropriate to say, clearly, the amount offered by the employer indicates that they were not planning on paying for expenses. Or do we say that, no, at the end of the day, the custom is the custom. Just because he gave him more money, it doesn't influence whether or not he'll have to pay for those extra benefits or expenses. That is a dispute. We actually side with the point saying that it doesn't matter in source number 11, and know that if he increased or decreased their wages relative to other workers, there is no proof to add or deduct benefits against the custom. It doesn't matter if you decided to give the guy a giant budget or not. Yes?
Supposing this business lunch, this $1,000 business lunch,
mm-hmm.
a really excellent deal came through for some multi-million dollar deal. Mm-hmm. Signed the dotted line, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So how would Halacha look at this right now? Because that is clearly to the benefit of the employee.
Yeah, but the employer would still say you could have gotten the same thing accomplished with $50. I'm out $950 because of it. Okay, now at this point, I think we should now shift from looking at the halachic elements or the legal elements of the employment law and to see whether or not we can glean anything from the tax law about business lunches in general, both in Canada as well as in other countries around the world. And to see if based on those laws, such a lunch would be appropriate and justified under the circumstances, and if as a result of that, we can say that it would therefore be appropriate or inappropriate for the employee to ask for reimbursement for such a lunch. And we'll begin with Canadian tax law. Again, I'm expecting that many of you can help me out with this here. But here we go. Okay, if we look at the CRA website, canada.ca, in the business expenses section, we're told the maximum amount you can claim for food, beverages, and entertainment expenses is 50% of the lesser of the following two possibilities. Again, this is condensed for space. Either the amount you incurred for the expenses or an amount that is reasonable in the circumstances. Okay, so in Canada, from what I understand, if you decide you want to take your prospective client to game one of the NBA Finals in Toronto, and you spend $10,000 a ticket there, so half of that amount can be deducted. Okay, that's the way I understand it. 50% will apply to those cases, 50% of those tickets. Now, do you need to talk any business at this game? I hear mixed, but the answer from what I understand is no, you don't. This is just a way of building a relationship. When it comes to food, okay, here we say two things. Amount you incur for the expenses or an amount that is reasonable in the circumstances. What does that mean for our case? Going back to the case of Jack and Joe, $1,000 lunch. How much of that would be deductible, accountants? How much could you write off of that business lunch?
Max would be $500.
So $500 would be the actual account, the actual amount that was spent. What would you say about the words reasonable in the circumstances?
That's a question of judgment.
So that's a question of judgment. So interestingly, if you look at the CRA's income tax interpretation bulletin in source number 13, you'll notice that it adds four words that were skipped out on the website. Okay, and we'll begin reading from the beginning. Subsection 6711 provides that costs in respect of the human consumption of food or beverages or the enjoyment of entertainment are deemed to be 50% of the lesser of A, the amount actually paid or payable in respect of these items, and B, an amount that would be reasonable in the circumstances, what does it say? To pay for them. That really modifies, yes?
Well, I'm not sure it does modify because I think what they're getting at is where, you know, you're paying a lot for something kind of unusual where there's some doubt about what it's really worth.
Correct.
But if that is the standard charge of that fancy restaurant in London mm-hmm. is very expensive and restaurants are very expensive mm-hmm. and you had a good high-quality meal, which is expensive, I think that you default to the situation that if it's for business purposes, then it would be deductible at that price. I don't think someone's going to say, well, the restaurant overcharged you. And you can't say that. Didn't know they charge you whatever to charge everybody for that. And I think I don't think CRA is likely to say on that case alone that that's an exorbitant fee.
Right, so I think that's exactly what it's coming to tell us. That this is coming, this rule of an amount that would be reasonable in the circumstances is referring to the cost of the items in question. No one's saying, as one possible way of understanding this, is no one's saying you should have a cheaper lunch. CRA is only covering, you know, is only going to cover you, let's say you do get overcharged. If you would get overcharged, they're telling you, you have to pay an amount that would be reasonable in the circumstances. But no one's telling you can't have a lavish lunch. And if a lavish lunch costs $1,000, the CRA would cover you for that $1,000. If I understand correctly, that's what you're saying. We agree.
No?
We don't agree.
No, because, again, you've got a reasonable in the circumstances also is a matter of the type of client you're taking to spend $1,000 on.
So that's certainly a factor, but bearing in mind, if this was the type of client who you said, instead of spending $1,000 drinking and eating with him, I'd like to spend $1,000 going to a baseball game with him, that would be somewhat justified. I agree that that's certainly an important factor.
From the NBA Finals, if you take a tax client and spend $10,000 on him, you're going to have a problem.
Right. So
and the other interesting thing that makes this complicated or interesting mm-hmm. is that if the employer, the fact that the employer will, let's say, does reimburse him, mm-hmm. that will be evidence for him with CRA.
Yes, that's absolutely the case.
And that's going to work in his favor. The fact that the employer didn't want to reimburse him is going to work against him if the CRA does a detailed audit.
Yes, that's going from the case to taxes. Yeah. But if we look at taxes to the case, Canada is actually pretty liberal when it comes to what is considered a business expense. It would be very easy from a tax perspective, again, bearing in mind the employer would or wouldn't want to reimburse him. But if the employer himself was just taking someone out to lunch, Canada would say, yeah, that whole lunch is a business expense. Now, let's take a look at some other countries. If you look at the IRS, okay, in the IRS publication 463, as discussed above, so first of all, entertainment's out. In the U.S., as of a year ago, apparently. Again, maybe some of you can fill me in on that. However, you may continue to deduct source number 14, line 2, 50% of the cost of business meals if you or an employee are present, and here's the big kicker, and the food or beverages are not considered lavish or extravagant. Here you've got a lot less room to deal with. In the U.S., we say, well, not we, but they say, in the U.S., they would say, listen, you know, spending $1,000 on lunch, come on. That may be lavish or extravagant. In fact, if you look in that bulletin, they even give you an example. If you take a client out to a $200 lunch, and this was the example given in the bulletin, and $110 is lavish or extravagant, so you only get your $45 that you can write off, the 50% of what was spent that was not lavish or extravagant. So from that perspective, now the employer can come back, okay, Joe can come back to Jack and say, listen, if you're looking at it from a perspective of tax law, What you spent was ridiculous. I'm not paying back all this money. I'd only be able to write off, you know, such and such an amount if this was me at the meal. So how can you expect me to say that this wasn't, you know, that this was an appropriate expense if it was very lavish and far beyond what would have been expected? So again, Canada, you've got more of a claim by the employee to say, listen, this is a legitimate business expense. When you go to the States, you know, you say, the government doesn't even consider this a legitimate business expense. The first 50 bucks, maybe. Not this. Interestingly, in different company policies, by the way, you'll see they actually have flat fees for food. And in fact, the tax laws also have flat fees under certain circumstances for food, but they're generally not when it's a business-type lunch. Interestingly, in this case, they traveled to where? What was our case that we created? Where did they travel? London, England. What does the UK tax law say about this? UK tax law is actually one of the simplest. They say there's two types of entertainment. Entertainment includes eating, drinking, hospitality, you name it. Entertainment's included, but there's two types. There's what we call in source number 16, business entertainment of clients, which means at this lunch, you discussed, and now we get back to your points from earlier, you discussed a particular business project or you formed or maintained a business connection. However, non-business entertainment, if you just get together for social reasons, meaning, e.g., entertaining a business acquaintance for social reasons, there's actually a difference. For business entertainment, okay, you need to report it, but you don't have to deduct or pay any tax or national insurance on those business entertainment. On non-business entertainment, however, you do. So if you look at it from an English perspective, it would really all depend on what you discussed at the meal. If you didn't say a word about business, but you were just having fun there, but it's true, it's for a constructive purpose, but that sounds like more like entertaining a business acquaintance for social reasons. If that would be the case, they wouldn't even consider it a business expense in the UK. Whereas if you did discuss at this lunch, they absolutely would. They say, yeah, that's a fine use of your time, money. Again, depending on how we would look at lavish, extravagant, and whether or not that applies in the UK. So being that we see from all these different tax laws that the claims made by the employee to the employer, he might be able to say, listen, the government, as far as taxes are concerned, does consider this a legitimate business expense or doesn't consider this a legitimate business expense. So I pose the question to you now, okay, do you think, going back to the question that really introduced this, would this constitute law of the land or common practice in this case? The fact that there are tax laws that define what a business expense is, at least from the government's perspective, would that influence what we would call law of the land, or would that influence common practice? Yes, no, maybe so. Any votes? Yes?
You know, tax law changes a lot.
Okay.
And this 50% was one
time. Was 80%, yep, we have that. It's in one of the sources there.
And you see different countries, like a lot of businesses are transnational.
Mm-hmm.
So they got people who have different places. I don't think it carries as much. It's not necessarily custom. I don't think it's necessarily custom.
Okay.
Because the tax department has a particular law and policy at a particular point in time that is the, going to be accepted as the prevailing custom.
Okay, so I had that same reason down. What I would think personally is that, number one, look at the difference between all the different tax laws here. You can see pretty clearly that this is not something that everybody agrees is something, you know, cut and dry and very, very simple, that everybody says this is a regular, normal business practice, and therefore certainly, you know, we'd expect the employer to reimburse the employee. You see it changing so radically from country to country, and again, even within it, if you look back, where was it over here? Back in source number 13, again, before February 22nd, 1994, subsection 67.1.1 provided that food, beverages, and entertainment expenses were subject to an 80% limitation. Right? That's the case. Number two, the fact that there's a 50% limitation, what does that tell us about the way the law views these business expenses?
They're already prescribing that half of that cost is a personal benefit. And that's
correct. So you could argue that it's about personal versus other people, but we don't have, for example, if one employee were to take out 12 prospective clients, it would still be 50%. Correct. So you can't necessarily say that it's a personal versus, you know, other person split, but you can say that it's clear that they don't think the whole thing should be paid for whatever the reason. They think perhaps you're overspending because you're taking this person out. They still don't agree that the whole expense should be 100% written off, like they do in other circumstances, which you can see back in source number 12, where they would allow you to write off the whole cost. So I think the amount of variability that we see here, as well as the fact that even the government itself wouldn't be interested in covering this, in taking this whole cost, so to say, is enough for us to say that this wouldn't create any sort of, certainly dina d'malchuta dina, that would be set by employer and employee law, if there were laws in this case, which there are in some places, as we said. But I don't even know that it would set a custom, just because what is a business expense with the government might not be a business expense between one person and another, and the government, you know, obviously is a much bigger entity, as the ability, you know, we work within the tax system, that's much bigger, and I don't know that you can necessarily draw parallels. However, I will note that I am almost certain, I would put a lot of money on this, that depending on the different places, people's practices tend to follow the tax laws a little bit, and I would guess that in places where the tax law is laxer in terms of writing off these type of expenses, these things are more common, and I would think in places where they're not as, again, generous with the tax laws, people are less likely to engage in such business. That's what I would guess. And if that's the case, it does have a little bit of relevance to the custom, but not necessarily. Now, as we come to a close here in the next couple of minutes, what type of ethics can we take out of this in terms of an employee entering into this in first place? If we look at it from the tax perspective, again, we see varying views. Some governments would say this seems like a very legitimate business expense to spend exorbitant amounts of money to woo clients. If not bordering on bribery, it isn't. But it has certain elements of that. Mm-hmm. In some cases, where you're really allowed to spend exorbitant amounts of money for social and personal reasons with, you know, other business partners or things like that. On the other hand, you have other places which say, listen, business is business. You talk about business, you do business, great, it's a business expense. If not, then it's not a business expense. And that being the case, you may have said that there isn't really quite any sort of clear ruling for what an employee should enter into under these circumstances. Was it right for the employee to take his employer's money and spend $1,000 of it, or so he thought, on this business lunch? Well, you don't really get a clear picture from tax law. So looking back at what we've covered in this shiur, and in this business lunch, shocking, we do get actually some indications as to how Jewish law would say circumstances like these should be treated, unlike the unclear picture we really get from the varying tax laws. And that is, there's actually a nice summary here from source number 18 from a publication called Workplace Halacha. In chapter 17, they have a discussion about use of office supplies, personal use of office supplies, and they write, in the absence of any prior agreement or discussion, halacha recognizes two standards, the preferences of the individual employer and the industry norm. So number one, employees should always be looking at what their employer might care about, rather than saying, well, I think I can find an excuse as to how I can make him pay for this, or make her pay for this. That's not the way it should be entered into. It should be, what might they be thinking if I was in their shoes? Also, the industry norm. Don't think that just because you can justify this as a business expense, you have to look at what other people would justify it, whether that be the law or whether that be something else. Because there are different opinions concerning an employer who's more particular than the industry standard, it's preferable in such cases to abide by the stricter approach and go along with the wishes of the employer. If an employer is more generous than the industry standard, his personal policy governs. Again, practically speaking, it's very difficult to establish an industry standard for many benefits. Some companies supply cell phones and allow personal use. Others do not. Some provide chocolates, coffee, medical benefits, etc., etc., etc. Next point. The higher this person's level within the particular business, the more benefits he will usually receive. In the absence of an agreement between the parties and in the absence of an industry standard which requires the employer to supply certain benefits or extras, the employer is not required to supply them, and the employee should not take them on his own without first obtaining the employer's consent. That's very important. The employer's consent, by the way, doesn't have to be from the top, top, top guy who owns everything. It can usually be from someone above you in some capacity. And finally, being that, and he writes, according to some legal decisors, some post-kim, if an employee is unsure about the industry standard or his employer's policy, he can fall back on the following assessment. Would he feel comfortable making personal use of company property or equipment in front of his employer? So the question that we can ask ourselves going back to our first case of Jack and Joe is, had Joe been around, would Jack really have had the same $1,000 business lunch? And that would make it a question of ethics. Meaning, was it ethical for him to do this in the first place? Even if we can say, in law, he might be entitled to a certain amount of reimbursement, which again, we're not coming to a conclusion on here. Ask your lawyer from a legal perspective or ask your rabbi from a halachic perspective. But the point is that looking back, if we were to just look at it from the perspective of tax law, you might be able to defend something like this and say, hey, the government calls it a business expense, why won't you? But we say there are more factors to it than just what the government looks at in terms of tax law, and those would be how your employer might think about it, as well as what the common custom is. And with that being the case, all of these different factors can lead us back to sort of a wholesome picture, saying there may be some reasons and some claims that the employer can have, there may be some reasons and some claims that the employee can have. Tax law doesn't really help us because of its variances in terms of the legal process, but it does tell us that ethically there are sort of a whole range of standards when it comes to what's considered a business expense or a business lunch, and therefore no conclusion from that perspective, but I think this was sort of a broader look at a topic that is really fraught with questions. Any final questions before we wrap up?
So the comment your friend made about Dina and Malchusa is not accurate at all in this particular situation.
I don't think that tax law would constitute Dina de Malchuta for employment law. If there was employment rules that were set by the government saying employees are always reimbursed by their employer in cases of business lunches, that would be different. So yes. Any further questions? Okay, well then we could look into that again from a... Okay, well there we have it. So that would be a Dina de Malchuta application. Okay, well thank you all very, very much for coming out. Once again, if you haven't signed in, please take the opportunity to. Thank you once again to... Thank you once again to Zeifman's and everybody involved in putting this together. It's been a pleasure to be here as time number one. And once again, if you see any details, if you're interested in attending our evening of tribute, details are on the flyers in front of you.